Well, welcome everybody to our SIO call. This one's an open call, and the design was that it would give us, the membership, a chance to just share a story and get feedback from others. And that story that we share could be something that's worked really well for us and we want other people to know about, or something that we're just developing and we wanted to get feedback on application. And then just to check in, I know David has something to share, and Tricia has something to share. And then anybody else? Okay, so...
Well, this is Geralyn. I would have something to share.
Okay, great, Geralyn. Good. Well, why don't we... We'll see how it goes. We'll take maybe 40 minutes to go through these, so maybe 10, 12 minutes each. We'll just see how that goes organically. It doesn't have to be that. But, David, you were first on the line there, I think,
okay,
for us, so maybe you could get us started.
Sure. Well, as a background for this, I'm putting together an academic journal article for a value-based leadership journal with Valparaiso University up in northern Indiana. So part of it's for here, but most of my work is with the C group and the board of directors, that types of thing. So that's typically who I address when I speak with folks. And I talk to them about
C group, so all the CEO and the
CEO, CFO, CIOs, yeah, name a C and I talk to them, basically.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's kind of the area that I work in, and talk to them about leadership. And it's so easy to talk about leadership when you have overwhelming odds, and there's many, many examples of, you know, people winning. Yeah, well, you won because you just were overwhelming. I prefer stories of overcoming overwhelming odds and the leadership that goes with it, and then usually ask the people, you know, what type of leader would you follow into your battles, and are you that kind of leader? So that's usually how I conclude things. Anyway, the story in the middle kind of dates me, but as I was doing some things for I made a presentation recently at the BNY Mellon, and I pulled some things out, and it struck me that this story was extremely appropriate, and it received, it really worked very well. So the way it goes is that for the 25 years from 1963 until 1991, the Russian hockey team was world champions for 23 of those 25 years. They were medalists at most of the Olympics. Frankly, they always expected to win because they had a talented, more mature team. Most of them were on active military duty. They just plain never lost. And on February 22, 1980, they met the United States hockey team that had an average age of 21 with no professional experience and no international experience to talk about. In fact, the team had never played together except for a long series of exhibition games held that fall. And the last game they played just 3 weeks earlier in Madison Square Gardens was against the same Russian team, and they lost 10-3. In spite of the fact that the Russians never played their first or second lines. They only played their third and fourth lines. So entering the Olympic Center, the Russian team was the defending world and Olympic champions. They had won the four previous Olympics, and everybody in the world except the United States hockey team knew what the outcome was going to be, that the Russians would win again. And in fact, in the five games leading up to the game with the United States, the Russians had outscored their opponents 51-11. The Americans were lucky to get into it because they had tied their first game, barely beaten a few others, and entered the Russian game with a 4-0-1 record. And as the game started, within minutes, the Russians had a lead, just as everybody had predicted. And, boy, the Americans played tough. Lots of determination, but they just could never get a lead back. But with 10 minutes to go in the third period, the Americans got their first lead. Now, most teams would be so thrilled that they'd fall back and play defense for the next 10 minutes. It's not what the Americans did. Instead of dropping back and playing defense against the greatest hockey team in the world, you know what their coach told them to do? Go play your game. Play your game. Don't stop. And they continued. They continued to play aggressive play instead of protecting the advantage that they had. It's totally rattled the Russians. They couldn't believe that this team of children had not only tied them and gotten ahead about them, but they're still playing tough. And they became very rattled. Now, because of the Russian record, a common play in hockey is that when you're behind and it's late in the game, you pull your goalie to give you a sixth offensive player. Well, the Russians never did this because they had never, ever been behind late in the game, and they had never practiced this play. They didn't know what to do. And as the clock came down, Al Michaels, a famous sports broadcaster, said what has now been famous. And as he counted down to 3, 2, and 1, finally said, "Do you believe in miracles?" And the answer was yes. Now, what's really interesting is after this game and for the next 19 years, the Russians were dominant. The Americans never won another Olympic after that time for several Olympics. They never won a world championship. But that particular night, on February 22nd, 1980, they became the greatest team in hockey by playing aggressive continually. That's the story.
Yeah.
For those that are my age and can remember the game, it really was it brought chills to you. It brought tears to you. It was an unbelievable moment, but we've quickly forgotten in the last 34 years really how spectacular that moment was.
This is Jules. I know exactly where I was at that moment when they were playing because my friend had twisted her ankle the night before at a school dance, and I was in a hospital in Yonkers wheeling her around. I wasn't wheeling. The attendants were wheeling her around at jet speed because they wanted to go from TV to TV, and the poor girl was jettisoned down the hallway. And then she was royally peeved when she got back to campus because apparently she was not the source of attention. And all you could hear was people going mad on the quad, you know, just crazy with, you know, amazement. So it was a forget the feeling. And she was like, nobody.
It was a unique situation. It's called the greatest sports moment of the 20th century of anything. And what's interesting is it wasn't broadcast live, what you were watching. Only the radio was broadcast live.
It was a delayed game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everyone recognized. It's just there's a lot of interesting things as I started to develop that. But when I present this to these folks and they start to think about it and you really are faced with these, you know, if you're a Fortune 500 company and you're facing other Fortune 500 companies, you will never go against these kind of overwhelming odds.
Mm-hmm.
It just won't.
Mm-hmm.
And yet
this
team of children did the impossible. You know, so it's but I find that to be there's a lot of military ones, too, that I can go through that have the same type of thing. But this one I think has some legs to it. It's gotten a pretty good reception, like I said, when I've used it a couple of times already. And if you're on a hockey team, it may not work well in Tennessee, but if you're in a hockey city, it works pretty well.
Yeah. One thing I really liked about it, the fact that it's true and people can recall it or have read about it is really nice. But I really like that moment when the coach says, you know, go out and play your game. Later you came back and said, you know, they didn't let up. They kept, you know, playing aggressively. But I just love that idea of play your game. And I think that has so many implications for business, you know, to decide what is their game and how do they play their game and what market is in their game and what style of leadership is really kind of like a metaphor for play your game.
Well, and that really came out in the last time I presented this. One of the folks at the bank said, you know, that's right. You don't let your competition decide what you're going to play. You decide how you're going to play the game. And so what they really got into that particular point there, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
This is Tricia speaking, and I really love the story. I wanted to ask you, what do you do at the very end of the story? Because you took us to the end and you stopped, and then we started talking about it, and then you made the comment, likely nobody in this room is ever going to be up against those kinds of odds. So I was, you know, which means to say there's lots that we can do. So I was curious, how do you end it there and then ask people what or what?
I'm a fairly interactive speaker, and I tend not to be behind podiums, and I roam around rooms, and I have a fairly loud voice, and I'm 6'4", 280 pounds, so I have kind of a presence when I'm in a room, okay? But that allows me that as I'm talking with a story like this, like this last time I did end it with the same kind of, think about Herb Brooks, who's the coach here and the leader. I mean, these kids followed him. I mean, this could have been the 300 Spartans fighting the I forgot those guys. They would have followed him anywhere for any reason. It could have been the folks in war. I mean, yeah, you know, he had the control. Sometimes it leads into discussion of what kind of leader was this guy, and I have some information on how this guy grew up. I mean, he grew up in a very poor family, and he never was a superb athlete, but he always believed that he could win everything. And so that part of that is part of leadership of winning. We talk about various aspects of the leaders. We talk about some of the aspects of as the Russians were getting behind with all those capabilities that you've had. How do you give up? How do you not know how to pull a goalie? I mean, how are you so arrogant in time? And I have quite a bit of study on organizational ecology, and in that it talks about the mortality of organizations, and that a company like BNY Mellon, can you really afford to be so arrogant to think that you don't need to know every trick in the book, that you might come up against an opponent someday that forces you to use it? And if it's a more mature, in my term for older audience, I talk about Studebaker a little bit, about at the turn of the century in the 1890s, Studebaker was the world's largest buggy and buggy whip manufacturer. When I was a kid in the 50s and the 60s, awesome car. Most folks under the age of 30, unless you like cars, don't even know what a Studebaker is now. And there's a lot of organizations. When I talk with the BNY Mellon, we talk about organizational arrogance. And they really get into this about, you just can't believe, just as you're the biggest and the biggest one out there right now, you need to know all the skills necessary to survive. So that's, I mean, it depends which way the audience goes. It depends how the audience wants to talk about things.
And I think that's really fascinating. And I guess I'm still thinking, you know, so do you throw a question at the audience, or do they speak first? Do you just wait and see what they say and then just go where it goes? Or is there something that you throw out to them?
Typically, I wait. I do my moments of silence to see what they're kind of mulling about. And they usually bring something up themselves or ask me a question.
Yeah.
If they don't, then I'll start talking about an area that I think is going to be relevant, like Studebaker or other organizations.
Okay.
This is Molly, and if we have time at the end, I got a good one about Eastman Kodak where I work, and y'all could use it.
What an amazing story, isn't it?
Huh?
Yeah. Great. I mean, that's an amazing story of Kodak and how they developed the digital camera and shelved it.
If we have time, I'll tell the story. I was actually in the board meeting when they decided not to partner with IBM to do a digital camera.
Oh, I'd love to hear that.
Oh, wow.
So
well, maybe you should just tell that.
Well, I don't want to take up everybody else's time. Tom, have we got time? It's not long.
I'll give you my time.
Listen, y'all can use this. I was sitting in the board meeting. I was a young chemist at Eastman Chemical Company, which is the chemical arm of Kodak, but they were still the same company. You know, George Eastman formed Eastman Chemical Company because he didn't want to be dependent on a supplier for his photographic chemicals or his cellulose base for the film. And so eventually Eastman broke off because they got involved with PET and other polymers. But at the time I came, I was in organic chemicals. My job was an analytical chemist, and what I was doing was tearing apart Fuji couplers and molecules to see what their film base, why it was different from ours. And the big dogs were coming down from Rochester. It was so funny back then because we rehearsed everything because you didn't. It was such an organization that was so hierarchy based. And when they came in, it was like the king came to town, right? And we're in this board meeting, and I was invited in to sit back in the back and shut up because I was too young, you know, to say anything valuable. And so at that meeting, IBM had come in to ask Kodak to partner to make the first digital camera. And they had a long legacy. I can remember being wowed. You know, it was like hearing some futuristic thing that was beyond belief. And this old stodgy VP, if I could remember his name, I would probably use it because the guy's probably long dead. But he stood up and he beat his hands on the table and he said, "This is the most ridiculous thing I have ever heard of." He said, "People will never have computers in their own home, and they will digital medium will never meet the resolution of halide chemicals to produce a stellar photograph." And at that point, it was canned, and the next thing they made was the disc camera. And if you guys remember that at all, it was an utter failure. And so that was really organizational arrogance.
Yeah.
So you guys are welcome to use the story because half of those people are dead.
That's a good one.
Did you... And Molly, when you were out working with different organizations, would you sometimes use that story?
Oh, yeah, I did. I was, you know, after I retired, I said, in fact, I used it within our own organization, even when I was at Eastman. I said, "Do you remember when this happened?" You know, and everybody go, "Wow, yeah," you know. And those who could remember would, you know, I don't even know how many people are left that were actually in the meeting because I thought it was such a learning story, you know. So I've used it within the company, but, yeah, I've used it a lot outside of the company because I think this organizational arrogance is a big thing, especially with older companies.
Hey, there's one other question I had for David, which was when you're working with the C groups, how many people generally are you working with? I mean, are you working with just those C people, like two or three?
Yeah, maybe half a dozen at most in a room. You know, if I'm working with another group of non, it goes back to arrogance, kind of. If I'm working with a non-C group, in that next level down, this, you know, the senior vice presidents, those kind of things, they don't play well together. I mean, typically they'll have me come separately.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just one of those things.
Okay. Well, let's move along to Tricia, who has something to share with us.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. This is a story that I am working on. I have not told it to a group yet. I've been sort of playing with it. And I'll set the stage. What I'm really looking for at the end is to have you comment on what would you take away from this? What would you see as how it resonated with you and how you could... Sorry, I think I lost you there for a minute. I'm back. Okay, so that's what I'm looking for, the application piece. So about a year and a half ago, I was in D.C. at Reagan National Airport, and my sister-in-law was dropping me off so I could catch a flight back on JetBlue from a quick visit down to see friends and family. And she happened to be a volunteer in something called the Honor Flight, and this is an organization that people show up and they greet the veterans who come to see the World War II Memorial. The Honor Flight arranges for them to fly in for the day, arranges for buses and for a police escort to take them to the World War II Memorial and then go back home that very night. So they stand actually at the where the people come in. And my sister-in-law was telling me all this and was dropping me off. And she said, "Actually, I have a few minutes. I think I'll go in and see if I can find them." And I said, "Well, that's great." And I said goodbye. as I walked through the terminal, JetBlue, I actually found my gate, and lo and behold, it was exactly where these veterans were coming in. And it was an amazing sight because you saw people standing on either side of a, almost like a runway. This was like the lobby area, but standing there, and they were cheering and they were applauding as these very old veterans, many of them, most of them in wheelchairs, came down from the plane. Some of them had family members with them. Some of them had younger members of their family. It looked obviously like grandsons and granddaughters in uniform wheeling them. The crowd, who were from the honor flight and just regular passengers like myself, stood there and applauded as they went by. There was a band, a men's group, choral group, with a piano, and they sang every single theme song from all the branches of the service. And as these veterans went by and they saw some insignia, they would start up, and the veterans would salute the band, and they would return that. So I could barely watch this. It was so incredibly moving. And at that moment, I realized, thought again about the amount of sacrifice and service these men and women had given. My flight was being called, so I left, and I actually got on my flight, got off in Boston, and I was standing out on the curb waiting for something called the Logan Express, which is a bus that will take you to another point where my husband would pick me up 5 minutes from my house. And as I stood there waiting for this bus, I saw the face of today's military. And there were four young people, a woman and three men, and they were Hispanic, African-American, a young woman, and they were Army. And they were dressed in their dress uniforms, and they were impossibly young and well and fit with their duffel bags. And I was so struck by the contrast between what I had just seen literally an hour before and then to see at this end the face of today's military. And I guess what I thought about that, or what it meant to me in some ways, was that the people, the young people I was looking at right now, could not know, as we all can't, what lies ahead of us, and that the men and women I had seen in D.C. had lived many lifetimes and certainly had a lot of stories to tell. Okay, and that's the end.
Okay. And then brief state again, Tricia, what would be helpful? What kind of feedback?
Oh, well, any feedback, but I'm particularly interested in what people would get from that, because I want to use this to kick off sort of some thoughts about how to tell stories, but also what it meant to me is maybe perhaps not it went to somebody else. So I'll talk about kind of what I thought about, and then I'm looking for the next piece, you know, which opens it up to the audience. And it could be as simple as asking a question, but I'd like to hear what people thought when they were listening to that, what came into their mind as they heard that.
Hi, it's Jules. I think the power of honoring somebody's story, taking the time to acknowledge that, what they've experienced.
This is Geraldine. The thought I had was you were seeing both ends of the spectrum, because not that long ago, those people you saw honored in Boston looked just like, maybe not same ethnically, but that same age and fitness and life ahead of them,
right.
You know, and going off into who knows what and what will happen.
This is Mark Goldman, and I'm wondering about a couple of things. One is how stories may change over time and in different settings. And the piece that I stuck in the middle, because I grew up in the 60s in high school, is the Vietnam War, when the veterans came back from Vietnam. It was a totally different response. And so I'm wondering if how it would change your story if you added that in terms of course, now, in the present, we're honoring those older, much older soldiers.
Right.
And in the 60s, we didn't. And I guess one question is, what do we say to those young men and women who are now, because there's no draft, who are now making a choice to go to defend our country and go in the military? So that just my thoughts about the same events of welcoming or of soldiers coming home is different in three different generations.
Yeah.
Thank you. It's great.
Mm-hmm. And Tom jumping in here. Like Mark, I did think about how the Vietnam vets were welcomed back. But something else that kind of jumped out at me was how kind of universal this could be to any organization. And often it's not until the very end that we acknowledge people and how powerfully that was illustrated in this story. And you were eyewitnessing that, and you did a great job of conveying that. But it's like there's an opportunity every day to notice what people are doing that's sacrificial, that's really beneficial, that's giving to others, and how valuable it is to acknowledge it right in the moment or just in the month that it happened or in the year that it happened or in the decade that it happened. Looking, that for me, this story is an example of looking for those things that need recognition and not waiting until somebody's about ready to die to give them that recognition that they deserve.
That's great, because that's actually how I will be using it in a business setting, and that's part of it, is trying to find that way to make this sort of personal universal story, but something about, how we view people maybe that we work with or our organizations, or just something about recognizing in the moment right now.
Yeah.
Okay. That is fantastic.
I love this. This is Molly. I love the story. You were breaking up some, so I got enough that I really love the story. I would have a tendency to think about using it to point out differences. Like I'm always using those kind of dilemma stories, just ending it and say, what do you think about that? And then opening it up so people can talk about it, because there's a lot of, generational diversity that could pull out there, and maybe some other belief systems. So I think it would be a really good story for a lot of reasons.
Okay, thank you.
At my, as I mull it over too, this is David, it's, when you think about organizational history and background and, honoring these men and women who come back for that, especially the greatest generation at World War II part, but even the ones later, about the importance of us as a country recognizing our past, and it's important that organizations recognize their past too, so that they can build upon that and go forward and, you don't, some of the past you're not going to like, some of the past you'll like,
right.
But whatever it is, it's your past, and you go forward from all those things and become a better organization.
Okay, thank you.
Good. Well,
that was
some
fantastic.
Good comments.
Thank you, everybody. That was great. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for sharing, Tricia. And Geraldine, let's just jump into what you have to share.
Okay, well, I'm getting ready to... Tom and I actually together are doing some work in Tulsa with a group that he's familiar with, but I'm not so familiar with. And one of the things we're bringing to the day is to talk about team building. And the story I've been thinking about bringing is still pretty amorphous, but I've got some ideas about it. So if I get wordy, I apologize now. So I taught in a school, a private school, for a number of years, and after working there for about 12 years, the school decided to reorganize its governance situation. And it had always been a school that was mostly faculty-run, There's never been a principal. There still isn't a principal. And faculty people would work in different ways in leadership roles, but what we ended up choosing was to have a pretty much a kind of single leader that had predominance over the other leaders in the school and was responsible for not only the pedagogical aspects of the school, but also the spiritual aspects of the faculty. And I was chosen as the first person to be in that role. And I had been doing some work outside of school with a community civic engagement group and had met this woman who was a vocal coach. And she did a lot of training with groups in team building. And I had the opportunity to spend a day with her where she taught us all some vocal exercises. And in the course of the day, she said something that really hit home for me. And it had to do with whenever people sang together, it synchronized their systems, their brains, their bodies, their thinking became synchronized as if you sang, even for as little as 3 minutes. And I thought that was just brilliant. So I took that to all of my faculty meetings that I was in charge of. And because of the position I was in, I was in board meetings, I was in parent meetings, I was in faculty meetings and in administration meetings. And anyone that I could be in charge of, I made us sing a song. And at first, everyone was a little bit, even though singing was pretty common in the school because it was a grade school and we do a lot of singing or did a lot of singing, meetings had not started with song prior to this. And I would choose a song and I'd put it out on the agenda and people would come and either they'd say, I don't know that song, or I don't know that very well, or I can't sing well, you can't make me sing. And I'd say, we're only going to sing a little bit of it. And it's, you know, we'll sing it through twice. And then I started making, you know, putting songs in that you had to sing through three or four times till I got people up to singing 3 minutes before a meeting started.
Wow.
And at first, people were not showing up to the meeting on time. Those reluctant singers. And they would come in just as the singing ended. And they'd get seated, and they'd always look a little, you know, uncomfortable. And I sort of went back and forth on whether or not I was going to say anything. And I thought, well, we'll just wait, and I'll see what happens. And I thought subtly, I have no idea, I'd have to go back and ask my colleagues how subtly I said things like, you know, the people who were here on time are actually, look at them, they look more relaxed. And people would look around and they'd go, well, yeah, you know, that's true. Or we would have had a little laugh. And just the fact of breathing that way would, you know, that you have, the way you have to breathe to sing, you can't hold tension. So, you know, and our faculty meetings would be from 4 to 6 p.m. on Thursday night. So that, after a week of teaching, it's, you know, it's not the ideal time, but it was the only time everybody could agree on, and it was sort of traditional, and people were okay, though, with my meetings. And one of the things that happened, there was a particular meeting that we had a visitor from the accreditation society that our school belongs to, because it belongs to a, I don't know if anyone's familiar with Waldorf schools or Steiner schools, but that was the school, and there's a national accreditation body for them. And we had a visitor there and to see how we operated, and we were trying to decide whether or not to rehire someone in this meeting. And when we came to this meeting, I thought, because it was a really difficult meeting, there had been a lot of problems with this teacher and a lot of complaints, and I thought, well, do we sing? And then I thought, no, we're going to sing. And I chose one of our actually more difficult songs that we would sing for the eighth graders when they graduated as the faculty. And it requires parts and some real thought, but definite breathing. It's a Mozart song. And we finished the song, we had the meeting, and people were very generous with each other, people who were not normally generous with each other in conversation. And comes to the end of the meeting, and we decided we had to let the decision was we had to let this teacher go, and there was no one who said we were making the wrong decision. You know, everyone was on board with it, and no one felt that we were persecuting this person or any of the things that had been sort of circulating beforehand, because everyone had had an opportunity to speak. And the meeting ended, and the observer told me, she came up to me after the meeting, and she said, "That's the most well-handled meeting I've ever been in. What do you think was the reason?" And I told her I thought it was because we sang. And she said she thought that might be true, that it was a very unusual, she'd never seen a meeting operated that way. Well, I had an opportunity last year to be at a conference with the woman who had taught me that singing process and made that comment that had made such a tremendous difference for me. And I was in that role of leadership for 3 years. And I told her about how I had taken her comment and, you know, gone and done all these things with it, and she did not remember saying that. It was the only occasion she thinks she may have ever said it, because she said, "I agree with what you're telling me, and it sounds like something I might have said, but I don't remember having said that." And I told her, well, that, you know, that's the spirit, from my perspective, working of you gave me what I needed. I was there to find something to run meetings well, and I didn't know she was going to be there, but she was there and gave me what I needed. So sometimes choosing something a little different or off from how you might run a meeting can bring a lot of life into it and help people to be less rigid in their perspectives and what they're bringing to the table. And that's where I'm at.
And Jer, what kind of feedback is helpful for you?
Well, I guess if the story makes sense or seems to have what people would take from that, if it would be useful, you think it might be useful in talking to a group about team building or community building or stress reduction.
This is Mark Goldman, and I think my first thought is the surprise at when you re-met this woman and she didn't remember saying that. And what I'm wondering is whether it's the actual fact that people were singing or the fact that you believed, you heard this, believed it so much and went ahead and used it, and it worked. And I wonder whether part of the story is about, regardless of whether something is tested or tried and true, as the leader, as David was saying, you believed so much in it that it worked.
Okay.
I mean, you're absolutely right. The passion and enthusiasm of the person delivering the narrative leadership is a big portion of what conveys the message to the audience. I mean, it's actually, I was looking at a study, and the impact on an audience in this particular study was 10% was the words. 40% was the emotions and the passion and how it was delivered to the individuals that really got the impact in the audience. Interesting when we think about the words are the most important part, but oftentimes it's not. It's how you deliver it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's getting beyond the words as well, is just the whole idea about getting people to a point where they can approach this difficult conversation in a slightly different way, and getting beyond the words, because the words can be loaded with all kinds of things, you know, about things about this teacher, and maybe a way the lesson might be, if you wanted a lesson, is like, how else can you come in that door? How else can you set the stage so that we don't jump into all that loaded language? I don't know if it's singing or moving your body or doing something different,
yeah.
But it's getting away from the letters and the words and the emotionally laden impact and the way people, out of words, we take sides. And I guess I was thinking when everybody's singing, they're just all singing. So
right.
When the words come in, we take up our positions. So I don't know, something to do with that.
Okay. This is Molly. I love the image of your doing that. I just think it's wonderful. I was wondering if you'd mind if I got the NSN board to sing.
I wouldn't mind at all.
We've got some really tough decisions made with transition, and I think I could do some good if I could get them to sing.
I'm just curious what song you want them to sing.
Oh, I don't know. That would be a whole other issue. You guys give me some ideas. I think it's brilliant. And what you did, not only from the technique aspect, but I agree with Mark, I think how it influenced you was a good lesson. I think it's a wonderful thing. I'd now just have to come up with a song that'll work with that NSM board.
I've got a few I can send you.
Well, again, you know, but I'm spanning from Kentucky all the way out to Oregon, so I got to get hit just the right song, you know.
Yeah.
This land is your land. Start with that. They probably all know it.
They may, well, not the younger ones, maybe, but the older ones, but they should know it, shouldn't they?
Yep.
And I was thinking in this story that how one of the things singing does is it helps us to listen to each other and to join together as one entity. And, of course, that's what you want an organization to be doing, is to listening to each other. So it might not just be only singing, although I think, you know, this is a great example of how something like singing could be remarkably effective. But maybe there are some other ways, too, to help put people into that place of listening to each other. So, and of course, every time that happens, there's team building occurring as people listen to each other. So, nice story. Any other comments right now?
Molly, if you're the lady that works for Kodak, I take it? Molly?
Molly, yes. David, Molly's cooking dinner because she does a big Sunday family dinner. And she said that she'd be on mute a lot of the time. And somebody just did leave the call.
I might have been her. That's fine. I was looking something up real quickly, and just for a point of interest for the rest of us, Kodak stock went from $97 down to 65 cents in that time period of organizational arrogance.
Oh, gosh.
$94 down to 65 cents. And then 2013, when they went bankrupt, they dropped off the Fortune 500 list for the first time. So you can imagine how it impacted the hundreds of thousands of ex-employees of Kodak, besides their pensions and benefits and all those things.
Right. Oh, my gosh, yeah.
I love the way you brought that in, because that's really, you know, that's the quantitative reality. You know, this is what happened. It's not that we could say, well, they just didn't pay attention to it, but the extension of how many people it impacted, you know, when that started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure it's easily 100,000 with retirees. And
the
I mean, that was a big company.
Which is huge, yeah.
Yeah.
But David, I was just going to say, it's only, I'm just thinking about the whole thing. We only call it corporate arrogance when it didn't work in hindsight. But how do we know in that moment? How do we know in that moment he wasn't right, or a Bill Gates is right or wrong? Or, you know what I'm saying? Is in that moment, we don't know who's right. There may have been a lot of people. What about the same situation where everybody in the company says, we need to do this, and the guy at the head says, nah, I don't think so. And then 5 years later, we find out he was right instead of the Kodak thing. So it's just a thought I had about.
No, I think it's a very valid thought. I think part of the arrogance is that there was not a whole lot of study done on looking at the value of the digital camera. They just didn't want to do it because they wanted to protect their cash cow. I think that's where the arrogance comes into play.
Uh-huh.
I agree. Each one will be a unique look at an organization.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Well, there's lots of good stuff to be thinking about here, and thank you, everybody, who contributed to the conversation. This was a nice, lively discussion and, I think, a real value to our group, even those who will listen to this later after the call. Next month, I'm hoping that we'll have our call during the storytelling conference, and we're going to be discussing exactly what's going to happen with that, but I'll inform everybody through our monthly newsletter and probably the recap here pretty soon. So thank you all for joining in the call, and have a great month. And if anybody has any ideas about the website that we're revamping, please send me an email, and we'll get that discussion going. But thanks, everybody, and have a great rest of your Sunday.
Nice job, Tom. Have a good Fourth, everybody.
Thanks. Bye.
Okay, okay. Happy Fourth.
Cheers.
Yep.
Thanks.
Thank you. And Mark and Tricia, go ahead and stay on if you are.
You bet.
Tom, I'm back on. I got dropped. So I'm back.
Oh. Yeah. Great. Thanks for rejoining, Molly. Just a second. I'm going to end the recording here.